Welcome to On Topic, a series of conversations with experts on issues of importance to Alaska. I'm Jim Johnson, president of the University of Alaska and the host of On Topic. Our mission at the University of Alaska is to serve our state through world-class research, top quality and highly accessible educational programs, and community service. One way we foster these core aspects of our mission is through conversation with distinguished scholars and practitioners. Our guest today is Michael West, Alaska's state seismologist, a UAF research professor, and director of the Alaska Earthquake Center. On the morning of November 30th, 2018, just a few months back, a magnitude 7.1 earthquake occurred near Anchorage, Alaska, causing widespread damage to the built environment near the state's largest city, as well as significant news coverage. Remarkably, no people died and very few people were injured, and recovery efforts continue to this day. The Earthquake Center at the University of Alaska reports tens of thousands of earthquakes each year in Alaska and in the Arctic, including, on average, magnitude 5 earthquakes every week. Dr. West and the Earthquake Center staff are focused on advocacy and education for earthquake and tsunami preparedness, with an emphasis on Alaska and the Arctic. Welcome to On Topic, Michael.
Thank you.
Glad you're here. So, November 30th, I was in Anchorage that day in a meeting. And with a lot of corporate CEOs talking about the university and how the University of Alaska can serve them. And we're on the third floor of a building, and all of a sudden the building started to shake. And we're kind of wondering, what's going on here? We pretty quickly all remembered our training, and we climbed under the table and rode it out. And then quickly got up and thought, wait a second, we've got some responsibilities here, like companies and employees and schools and that sort of thing to address. So the group very quickly disbanded to get to their work of assessing the damage and then trying to recover. You were here in Fairbanks that day, right?
I was.
And what was it like at the Earthquake Center? What, roughly 7:30 in the morning, I think it was?
8:30?
Okay.
Yep, 8:30.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like a starting gun went off.
Really?
At 8:31 that morning, mm-hmm. on a journey or a race that hasn't really quite ended yet.
Really?
But I think you hit on really key points. After you all got up from the underneath the tables, wherever you were, and started to assess and said, well, what now? What's happened exactly? That's the Earthquake Center's role. So at the same time that you were feeling that earthquake was being picked up by sensors, by a whole network of sensors around South Central Alaska, and you know, we began putting together the pieces, if you will, of, you know, really in the first minutes, it is what was that? You know, you cite a magnitude 7.1 earthquake. That's a computation, a calculation that comes out of our shop and working with colleagues. And, you know, in the first minutes, it's really a matter of what was that? Where was that? And how big was it? Really basic information. But as people go about trying to figure out how to respond, that becomes tremendously important.
I recall being under the table and a gentleman who was not far from me pulling out his phone and very quickly going to the Alaska Earthquake Center to see what information was available while we were still under the table writing this thing out.
Wow.
So I share that with you because, and I'm sure you're aware of it, the information you provide and the role of assessing and analyzing this is really important to people as they are, while it's happening, trying to understand what's going on.
I'm not sure everyone understands all the different facets of that. We obviously put a lot of time and attention, or the public does, on this first question of, you know, how big was it? Where was it? But there's a whole lot more nuanced information that's really important in the hours following the earthquake. So that piece of information, how big was it, where was it, you know, within a minute or 2 minutes, we're starting to get a handle on that. And that improves over the course of tens of minutes, maybe. But over the first, call it the first hour, and then refining that, we begin to produce maps of where the shaking was strongest. And that's actually really important, because to an engineer or to an emergency responder, where an earthquake happened, how big it was, isn't really what translates to potential damage. All they really care about, all an engineer should care about, is how much did the ground right here shake? Did it exceed the design standards for my bridge? You know, did it exceed the design standards for this, you know, pipeline or utility line or whatever? And that's actually something that is different than kind of a dot on a map, if you will. And over the course of, the first hour or so, that becomes really, I think, a signature product. And in an earthquake like this, a lot of decisions then get based on, whether the shaking was stronger in Palmer, Mat-Su, downtown Anchorage, Chugiak. That's where, Department of Transportation, for example, decides how to prioritize inspections. FEMA uses that information to decide where to begin staging equipment or people. FEMA, USGS, other federal agencies use that same information, the amount of shaking, to make very early estimates of damage. So, when the president or someone says, here's an earthquake, they evaluate emergency declaration or disaster declarations and whatnot in the early hours, part of what they're looking at is forecasts produced by FEMA and others based on that amount of shaking. So we're very much in the information providing role, and those are some of the key products, I think.
Well, from personal experience that morning, that information was really important. I went from that building, actually took a disabled person home because her transportation wasn't available and she wasn't able to stay in that facility. But then I went to our command center, and the data you're just now talking about was on the table and being looked at very carefully, because even here at the university, we have facilities all over that area. We have them in Palmer and Matanuska Valley and in Eagle River and all around the municipality of Anchorage. So the kind of information you're talking about was being used by our response people very quickly and directly. So a quick thank you for that, because it was very, very helpful.
Good. We've got quite a team.
Yeah, so. That's great. What have you learned? I mean, it's now several months, something like 6 months from the earthquake, 5-6 months. Are there additional learnings that you and your crack team here at the university have picked up, developed since then, that you'd like to share?
Anytime you have an event of that size, while it is not welcomed, while it is not something we want to happen, it is in some sense an experiment. It's a natural experiment that we don't get to, nature doesn't run very often for us. So there's a tremendous amount to learn, all the way from the basic earth sciences. Why does an earthquake like that happen? What should we expect in the future? Is that, how rare is that? Those kinds of questions. All the way through to the engineering side of things. We thought we built to withstand, X, and now X happened. How did we do? So there's a whole range of research activities that are ongoing right now. I mean, not solely here, certainly, but this earthquake actually drew considerable attention from the lower 48, because, again, it's been many, many years nationally since we've had an earthquake like this in an urban environment where you can, to test, if you will, some of these things.
The buildings in Anchorage, many of them are relatively new, at least since the 1964 earthquake. And I think that probably is one reason why the area actually withstood this so well, at least at the university, no structural damage. And what we did learn is that fire suppression systems are very vulnerable to being shaken, like a 7-point earthquake would do. And so that was a real interesting learning there. So to strengthen those mountings and other kinds of things in those. Also in labs, chemistry labs in particular, we ended up with a whole lot of glass on the ground. And how do we secure those valuable research tools so that they're not as vulnerable? So we picked up a lot too from that.
I hadn't heard that last one. That's interesting. A chemistry lab, absolutely. It's one of these things, in hindsight, well, of course that sounds like a vulnerable environment. Lots of glass vials and whatnot.
Definitely. And a lot of books on the floor.
Sure.
But to the extent there was cost, it really was the water, I think, and beakers and glassware, that sort of thing.
There was substantial flooding damage in quite a number of facilities, largely tied to fire suppression systems, or just pipes in some places. But that's definitely among the minor lessons, but definitely a lesson coming out of this is that those systems, they trigger on very subtle changes.
So. You mentioned, Michael, that folks outside of Alaska are interested in this earthquake. From my understanding, Alaska is a bit of a hotbed for earthquakes. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Alaska compared to other places and the earthquake frequency and here.
Alaska is, to use an overused phrase maybe, a natural laboratory, but it really is true from an earthquake perspective because not only do we have a large number of earthquakes, 4 out of 5 earthquakes in the United States occur in Alaska, but we have a diverse suite. That is, we have earthquakes that occur for many, many different kinds of geologic reasons. And so there aren't many kinds of earthquakes. There aren't many styles that aren't represented here. You add to that the fact that in many places in Alaska, you can have a large earthquake that doesn't necessarily do considerable damage. A magnitude 7 earthquake is by no means rare in this state. And the majority of the time, those earthquakes occur in a place that doesn't have the kinds of impacts that happened on November 30. And so it makes for, I mentioned this spectrum of research from kind of the core earth sciences part through to the engineering part. We are a stellar place for that core understanding of earthquakes, because there's a lot of them happening, and we're quite often we're not necessarily dealing with the kinds of implications and societal impacts that we had on November 30. So that's long been recognized, and I promise you there are a lot of researchers at prestigious universities across the U.S. who have made their careers on Alaska or earthquake issues specific to Alaska.
Why did you come to Alaska as a seismologist?
Came here because there was an opportunity. I was drawn by the opportunity to do work that wasn't esoteric. I had participated in some research projects earlier in my career that were good science, but didn't have a lot of immediate societal connection. And I really liked the idea, as do most of my colleagues, frankly, here, of the idea of working on a core fundamental science, but in a location where you get to connect the dots through to how this impacts society. So when a job opportunity came up, that was certainly attractive. But I have to add in, the other part of that is my wife and I came up and made the decision. We looked and said, well, is this where we want to live? And that was actually kind of a no-brainer.
Why for you seismology? You could have selected a host of scientific disciplines to pursue. Why seismology? What got you interested in seismology?
I'd love to have some origin story that when I was 4 years old, this happened, and I have no such story. I was always drawn to physics. I was a physics major undergrad, looking for something applied again. And I liked waves. I liked wave physics, and I thought for many years I'd go into optics, right? Optics, light, there's all about wave properties and whatnot. But and then I took a geology class and I realized, wait a sec, you can connect these two. You can do physics on geologic applications, put the two together, it's geophysics. And really it was one day, senior year of college, the light clicked and I said, I want to do geophysics.
Tell me about the U.S. Array. This is a series of facilities, research facilities, essentially, sensors that are all around Alaska. And they've been deployed all across the United States as well, but they're here in Alaska at this point. What do you learn? What really is the U.S. Array, and how important is it for your research, and not just for knowing more things, but also for application to the kinds of issues and challenges that interest you?
So let's take the first part of your question there. A little bit of history.
Good.
Seismology in or earthquake science in Alaska really got its jump start after the 1964 earthquake. Not a surprise. There were fledgling efforts prior to that. But after 1964, several different groups, agencies, began to take earthquake monitoring reporting kind of in a serious way. And we began to put out networks of instrumentation that would facilitate that, right? If you can't record it, you can't really, there's no data to work with. But those were very scattershot, opportunistic, funding-driven kinds of decisions. One year, maybe we'd be able to put in some instrumentation in the Denali region, and another year, maybe down in the, you know, the Yakutat area or whatnot. There was never much of a, we've never had the opportunity to step back and kind of take a holistic view of the network that underpins all of this research and monitoring. Okay, fast forward to 2014, and a major National Science Foundation project rolled into Alaska and essentially did exactly that. They said, you know what, for our earth science, for our research purposes, we're going to put out a grid of instrumentation. We're literally going to space out instrumentation evenly across the state for a couple of years, because it was a research project. They were going to collect data, you know, they wanted, and then go off and do research on that in the years to come. And that happened. That whole facility, that grid of 270 instruments came into being and has been a complete and utter game changer in our world, particularly in areas outside of South Central. So the Alaska Peninsula, Western Alaska, Northern Alaska, the Brooks Range, places where we have earthquakes, and we've always kind of known they were there. We can tell something's happening. It's like hearing, thunder and knowing that, oh, there must be a storm over the horizon. Can't really see it, but it's over there. And U.S. Array, the U.S. Array facility, has given us that ability to be there where it's happening and to record that data.
Very interesting. What does it, looking forward, if that array stays here in Alaska, what are the kinds of issues, problems, challenges you see being able to study with that phenomenal facility?
Sure. So it's certainly no secret of anyone who's been hanging out with me for the last 5 years that we are in a considerable effort, or have taken on a considerable effort to try and retain significant portions of that facility, specifically because I don't want to go back to the Dark Ages. I mean, I don't exaggerate too much. The specific things that would bring for us are an ability to estimate the earthquake hazard in different parts of the state. So you want to build something. I don't care what it is, a school, a pipeline, a port. Any engineering effort will take into account the best estimate of the earthquake hazard, we say. And our knowledge, our understanding of that hazard, that is, how often and how big of earthquakes should we expect, is based on what we know about, based on the, you know, what we've seen in that area before. And if we haven't been there to record it, then we don't really have a feel for that. Let me give you an example. Last August, there was a magnitude 6.4 earthquake just south of Kaktovik, largest earthquake ever recorded on the North Slope. And if you were to look at the hazard, you know, the official data on this, you would find that that is an earthquake that was expected to happen about once every 2,500 years. Now, I would submit to you that either this was a freak event and we just, it, that 2,500 year cycle just happened to have hit in 2018, or we misunderstood the hazard in the first place. Now, the verdict is still out on that, but just from a probability perspective, I'm going to guess it was we were wrong in the first place. We're seeing that even with the November 30 earthquake. That is an earthquake. The amount of shaking that was experienced during that earthquake is something very roughly that the hazard maps would suggest happens maybe once every 400 or 500 years. Well, it did that in 1964. We came awfully close in 2016. Now we've got this. So either we happen to be in a particularly active period, again, just coincidentally happens to be a very active time, or we have not yet accurately calibrated that hazard. And that is what, I mean, to me, that is what the USRA facility will provide in a uniform way across the whole state.
That's very exciting. Even for a non-seismologist, that's exciting. I'm going to change direction just a little bit. One of the topics that is on many people's minds these days is climate change. And I wonder if there is, you know, you talked about correlation just a moment ago, and I wonder to what extent are there any examples of there are ways in which the change in climate really on the surface of the Earth is impacted by or relates to earthquakes. You know, a pedestrian student of this like myself might say, well, wait a second, the forces that drive earthquakes are from deep within the Earth and are unlikely to be affected by changes of climate on the surface. But I suspect I'm probably wrong as I'm a pedestrian. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that. Are there some insights you have from your work here at the Alaska Earthquake Center that maybe connects those two?
So there are many different forces that impact what we see on the surface of the Earth, right? Earthquakes are in part driven by big sort of plate tectonics motions, you know, the movement of rock, you know, deep beneath the surface of the Earth that to date appears to be relatively insulated from a changing climate. However, there's a whole bunch of processes that happen on the surface that are absolutely driven by that. So a couple that I would single out for you, or back up. When we put a seismic instrument in the ground, it's actually not a very smart device. It records anything that shakes the ground. Might be an earthquake. Might be school kids walking by. It might be, you know, a moose. It might be a glacier. It might be a landslide. We pick up anything that vibrates the ground. And the two things that have changed. One, we see, you know, in a glacier's calving. So when you take a tour in, along southern coastal Alaska and you go out to the glacier and watch the big pieces of ice calve off, well, those are crystal clear across the seismic network. So we've been recording for many decades, you know, hundreds of events, hundreds of these big calving events every year. So there's a nice record of those, obviously, clearly tied into the frequency of those tied into climate change. The other one that's maybe more significant is landslides. There is growing evidence that as frozen rock begins to thaw, frozen soils in mountainous areas begins to thaw, as valleys that were once filled with glaciers, as those glaciers retreat out of them, it's kind of like removing the buttresses on an old cathedral or something. There's growing evidence that some of our mountains slopes are becoming less or becoming destabilized by changes in the climate. And every landslide leaves, you know, a clear seismic record. When you move that much rock, I mean, that's something that's clear as day across the network. So that's still an evolving concept, but there seems to be scientific consensus that landslides, potentially in coastal areas specifically, could very well be on the increase as climate changes.
There are landslides above the water. There are landslides below the water surface. Could you talk about that a little bit? I think we've experienced those here in Alaska, and they have actually caused damage to underwater infrastructure. And I wonder if you have any observations on those, because we don't see them. Our eyes can't see them because they're underwater, but they are happening.
I think this is one of the most fascinating hazard stories in Alaska in 100 years. I really do. Underwater landslides, as you point out, there's nothing to see, right? Turn out to be of tremendous importance to us as a state. In 1964, out of 130 people or so who were killed in the earthquake, the vast majority of those were killed by the tsunami. And it took a few decades to puzzle out, but we've learned that the vast majority of the people who died in the tsunamis were actually from what we might term local tsunamis. If you have a big earthquake like that, it sets up tsunami waves that roll out across the ocean, right? You record that in Chile and Hawaii and Japan. And then there's the waves that come on shore. But at the same time, when you shake the ground, all that, I'm not an oceanographer, the muck, the very soft soils that aren't very compressed at all, those slough off of our in our bays and our narrow fjords and generate very significant waves that are maybe don't propagate across the ocean, but are tremendously impactful on the communities that are close by. And the reason we have a lot of this, think about our landscape. Let's go back to our tourism. You know, we're on a cruise, right? Very popular for tourists. You pull into an Alaska port. You know, picture your postcard. It's usually a town with very steep mountainsides, probably some glaciers in the background, snow-capped peaks. Those glaciers are just pouring sediment out of the mountains. Right, a glacial stream in Alaska, you know, it's got that milky, chalky kind of silt in it. There's massive amounts of sediment coming out of the mountains. And all of that goes into these narrow fjords and gets dropped right on the bottom. It gets, you know, layered down as layers of very, very soft, unconsolidated muck. And it doesn't take a lot of vibration, doesn't take much of an earthquake to shake those loose and create devastating tsunamis in the local area. So I really honestly believe that is among our very top natural hazards in this state, and not really well appreciated until really the last few decades.
Interesting. Tell me about your educational mission and outreach mission. Obviously research is critically important, but it's applied to these real issues that are happening in our world. What is the Alaska Earthquake Center? What do you do personally in terms of educating Alaskans, but others around the world about these hazards that you're talking about and advances in your understanding of these hazards?
A lot of pieces to unpack in there. The Alaska Earthquake Center's mission is tripartite. Mm-hmm. Research is obviously at the core, because if we don't understand what's going on, we don't have anything of value to share. Monitoring is the second component, because that's where our information comes from. We are fortunate to live in a place where there's a lot to observe, and that's where we learn our lessons, you know. So our research is founded on, you know, that monitoring effort, but none of it is of much use unless we're engaging the public. So public engagement is that third component, something we've really tried to emphasize in the last number of years, because we do feel there is there's something important to share. And so you mentioned coordinating with colleagues elsewhere in the world. There are many lessons to be learned from other places. We're hobbled a little bit in Alaska because our historical knowledge, written historical knowledge, is not nearly as deep as it is in some parts of the world. So earthquakes are, you know, they unfold on human or longer than human timescales. What does it mean to have an event that maybe only occurs once every 500 years? How do we study that if it hasn't happened? You know, if no one recorded it 500 years ago or took notes. And it is fair to say our record in Alaska is not terribly deep. But if you go to a place like Japan, which has some similar issues to us, they have written records, you know, very detailed written records from 2,000 years ago. And you can piece together the history, the behavior of some of these monster faults that don't happen, the 1964 type things that don't happen frequently. So we have a lot to learn from other places in the world. That collaboration is really important. And the converse is true too. They come here, we entertain a lot of international research visitors, if you will, who are here because there are features, faults, events that happen here that maybe they haven't seen where they're from.
What would you say to a young person, let's pick a seventh grader, what would you say to that young person if he or she asked you, why should I become a seismologist? What would you say about the work you do that could inspire that young person to follow in your path?
That's a heavy load. you know, I would honestly tell them that, look, there are a lot of different paths you can go down in this road. I strongly encourage you to go to consider a scientific field and, you know, something that that happens to intersect with your passions. For whatever reason, I was turned on by the physics of waves. I don't know why. I was just wired that way. So you got to connect with something, you know, whatever scientific discipline it is that works for you. But the other thing I would say is make sure you're doing something that matters. There are a lot of choices in the world of science about where you can apply your time and talent. And I think there's a lot to be gained from specifically seeking out things where you say, you know what, I think I can make a difference there. And yeah, I happen to think seismology, earthquake science, tsunamis, et cetera, are certainly a place where you can do that.
Well, Michael, thank you. I think your comment there is very powerful and applies to your work, but also to many other fields of study where young people can make a difference, to have a passion for whatever it is they do, and that it matters. That's a powerful combination, and I want to thank you very much. It's clear that you have the passion and the work you're doing matters, and I want to thank you for that, and thank you for your time and this interesting conversation. Appreciate it.
Thank you.